I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show. Every Monday, Mark and Anthony are together here on the air. You can hear Anthony all by himself every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. here on the same station. But we share the spotlight here and enjoy it every week, and maybe might do the same tomorrow.
It just might happen.
Folks, we have a lot to talk about this next couple of hours, and you know, lots of going on in the news that we'll be covering. One of the things that happened in the news that I saw actually for the first time, and I mean, I knew this research was going on, but there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that popped up first and then the New York Times about Ardipithecus ramidus. I hope I said that correctly. I'll find out in a moment when I introduce our guest, who is 4.4 million years old. It was the newest fossil skeleton in Africa, and it really, after all these years of analysis, it begins to change for some people a lot of the arguments we had around evolution and what evolution means, and in terms of where we began and where this Ardipithecus fits in, Ardi, as it's affectionately called. We are joined by phone by Ann Gibbons, who's a Science Magazine contributing correspondent, author of the book The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors, and has written some interesting things on this discovery that we just discovered today. And Ann Gibbons, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. 410-319-888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to Facebook, to the Mark Steiner page, and we've already thrown a question up there about Ardipithecus, and you can start discussing that among yourselves, and we'll put your thoughts in the airwaves as well. So talk about this discovery, Ed. This is, I mean, how this is kind of a really revolutionary change in what we've known in the past.
Well, I can say right out, I've covered human evolution for, I have to say, almost 19 years for Science Magazine, and this is the most exciting set of fossils that I've ever written about. So it's the real thing. It's such a rare thing to get a skeleton. There are only 6 partial skeletons older than a million years. This is the oldest. We've never seen anything this old, and I like to sort of say that it's as if you had a book about the human story, but you're missing the first chapter. And Ardi gives us the first glimpse of these, in detail, of these very, very early days at the dawn of humankind. It's not the oldest fossil, but it is by far the most complete. And so by seeing all the body of Ardi, the different parts, how they come together, we get a really good sense of how she was moving and living in her environment and what she isn't, that she doesn't look much like a chimpanzee, and that's one of the first big surprises because, as we know from genetics, chimpanzees are our closest relatives. We share 99% of their DNA, but Ardipithecus doesn't look like a chimpanzee, so that starts to change our picture of the earliest stages of being a member of the human family.
And I'd like to follow up on that point. There's several points you just raised that I'd like to bring up, and I'm sure that Anthony has his own points to bring up. But some of the arguments I've been seeing from some people seem to indicate that there may be a discussion going on about whether Homo sapiens, human beings, whether we actually were descended from primates or whether we grew independently as another species. Is that part of this discussion?
There's a little confusion around it. We are definitely descended from primates. We are apes. We are primates.
Uh-huh.
We came from apes. But what we didn't come from is an ape that looked like a chimpanzee or a gorilla. We don't look like the African apes. We were descended from an ape. It's kind of an ape that lived long ago, 6-8 million years ago, something like that in Africa. But it was a different ancient ape. It didn't look just like a gorilla or a chimpanzee. It didn't walk around on its knuckles. You know how a chimpanzee will sort of put its weight on its knuckles when it's upright. It didn't eat mostly fruit. It may not have been as aggressive as male chimpanzees, which can be really nasty, extremely competitive. This creature, Ardipithecus ramidus, Ardi, had canines that were smaller. They weren't big dagger-like canines like you see in a chimpanzee, which are used to bite and to threaten other males, male competition for mates. So it begins to suggest that our ancestor was an ancient ape that maybe had a different social structure. I mean, this is some of the more controversial part of it because it's very hard to determine behavior from bones, if you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But one idea, one hypothesis that's been floated by these authors is that the males in Ardipithecus ramidus weren't competing or fighting as fiercely for their mates. So maybe there were new social structures. Maybe there was more cooperation in these groups so that they didn't have to be as fiercely fighting, and also so they could live on the ground more, not always have to retreat to the trees for safety. Maybe they had a better safety network. So there's some very interesting ideas being thrown around. But yes, we are primates. Yes, we came from apes, but we are not chimpanzees. That's probably the most important message. They've been evolving for 6-7 million years, too.
As we have.
As we have. They've gone down a completely different path, is what we're learning.
Ann Gibbons, this is Anthony McCarthy. I have two very quick questions. I find this fascinating. What else do we learn when we find these intact skeletons? I mean, do we find out things from that are around the skeleton, whether it's, plant life or seeds, or what else do we find out when we are fortunate enough to find something like Artie?
Well, this is the really cool thing about this set of papers. We've waited 15 years for them. This team, and I was lucky enough to go to Ethiopia with them and in the field last December. I spent 10 days in the field and went to this site. This site is now almost sterile. they hoovered up every single fossil, every plant, every specimen. They get on their hands and knees and crawl across this site over and over again, sucking up everything. And what they got were 6,000 biological specimens. That ranged from millipedes, fossilized centipedes, fossilized pollen, tree bark, you know, old fossilized trees, every kind of animal that lived there. These are amazing clues. This is the best kind of forensic evidence. They were able to reconstruct, one, what kind of animals lived there, two, that it lived in the woods. It was a forested habitat. They can tell by the plants, and again, the kind of animals, because they were all animals that live in the woods. Three, what kind of food it was eating. They even took little samples of five. In addition to finding the skeleton, they found bones from 30 or teeth from 35 other members of its species. So they have a little bit of a population. And they took isotopes, chemicals, out of these five of their teeth, and they were able to say, hey, look, it ate the kinds of plants that are in a woodland, not the kind of plants that were in a big grassy savanna.
Wow.
So it's what Tim White, who's one of the lead authors of the paper, calls a time capsule. They have reconstructed Artie's world. They have Artie, and they've put together her world. What kind of an environment did she live in? What kind of animals did she see? How is she living and eating and thriving in that world? Which is really quite remarkable.
And then I guess I have another real quick question before I turn it back to Mark.
No.
When I was reading the research that our team put together today, it was fascinating. How did the researchers determine that Artie was female?
Well, two reasons, partly the teeth, but also she's smaller. They can look at the size of the area in the skull, the brow, and the teeth, and she was the most petite specimen in the sample of teeth and bones from 35 different individuals. I think they had teeth from 22, around two dozen individuals. And so size is a lot of how they determine sex. They had her pelvis, but I don't think they could tell she was a female from that. I think that was mainly from looking at the teeth. One thing that was cool is they discovered that in some species of early human ancestors, some of the early hominids, as they're called, the males are a lot bigger than the females. In this species, it doesn't look like the males were a whole lot bigger, which is interesting. That gives you a glimpse of maybe a social structure where there's more cooperation. That's a bit controversial, but it's an interesting idea to be followed up.
But all the questions about the social structure in Ardipithecus, are they conjecture? Are they based on something beyond that?
Well, what you have when you have fossils is first you have the description, which is the hard evidence. No one argues with that. The descriptive detail of the fossil, the hard facts, everybody's excited about. They agree that this is phenomenal. Yes, these features are there. Where the controversy is interpreting those fossils, and you're absolutely right. When Owen Lovejoy, he's one of the authors that has come up with a hypothesis about why we began to walk upright, because when he looks at the pelvis and the hands and feet, he thinks he sees very strong evidence that Ardipithecus ramidus walked upright. And that is one of the defining traits of being a member of the human family. The ancestors of other apes didn't walk upright. Only members of the human family walked upright. But this is a very primitive form of upright walking, so not everybody is as sure as he is at this point that Artie was walking upright as well as he said. So that's one of the areas that will be debated. The other area that will be debated is, does that smaller canine really show a change in social structure? And then there's one other area, which is, are we sure that just because Ardipithecus doesn't look like a chimpanzee, that the earlier ancestor that we shared with chimpanzees, because we did share an ancestor with chimps at one point, didn't look like a chimpanzee. There's some areas of debate that will be worked out over time. It's how science works. You know, you take the evidence and then you debate about what it's showing. You test that, these hypotheses.
Do we think that we know what that common ancestor is?
We know that there was a common ancestor. Geneticists think that probably it lived between 5-7 million years ago, because we know that chimps are our closest relative because we share our DNA is more like a chimpanzee's than any other living ape. Gorillas are our next closest relative, and then you go to orangs and then gibbons that are more distant. So we know that they are our closest relative, and based on the number of differences in our DNA, can kind of work like a clock to tell you roughly when you shared an ancestor. But just because we're more closely related doesn't mean that that ancestor we shared with chimps looked just like a chimp, right? It didn't look just like a human either.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Owen Lovejoy and Tim White, the co-authors, are saying, maybe it looked a little more like a human than a chimp. That's to be, you know, that way. And if you look at your hands, for example, this is this cool thing they're saying, that if you look at your hands today, that's an echo of an ancient ape. Our hands are more primitive than a chimpanzee's hand, which has evolved to walk, to knuckle walk. You know, that'll be something that needs to be tested. Hopefully they'll find more fossils, and we'll test it.
What do we know when people write about, research this and kind of just and think about the earliest formations of humankind? I mean, there was a found, I forget when, but the even older, that the Sahelanthropus that was found in the,
yes,
Sudan, right?
Chumai, yes, that's a skull. It's 98% complete skull. It's between 6 and 7 million years old, from Chad.
So now, how does that fit into this picture?
This is very cool, and this is kind of what I explored in my book. Sahelanthropus is the oldest fossil that's vying to be a human ancestor. This skull is remarkable. It shows traits that you only find in later members of the human family that you don't find in chimpanzees, gorillas, or other apes. So it looks like it's an early, early member of the human family. But one of the defining traits of being a member of the human family is to walk upright. And it's very hard to show that a skull without a body walked upright. There are hints that it did, because the way the skull sits atop the spine, you can sort of see angles at the base of the skull that suggest that. But it's by no means 100% total convincing, you know, beyond a doubt evidence. So that's the earliest known thing out there. Very important, very exciting. Then we have a thigh bone that's about 6 million years old that looked like it might have walked upright, but not a lot of other parts. Then Arty has a relative, another species of Ardipithecus, that was at 5.8 million, but it's kind of teeth and a few other bones. So how these things all fit together, these earliest members of the human family, is a big question. Are they all kind of members of the same big family or genus, or were there several different kinds of early members of the human family? That's what we need more fossils. What these guys need to do now is, if we could order up fossils, right? Because it's just so darn hard to find them. If we're going to say, go out and get us, what they need now is a little skeleton that's older, and then one that's a little bit younger, because Artie starts to shed light on what happened right after her, too. You know, between Artie and Lucy is a million years, and some really important things happened. Artie has this opposable big toe, which means she was spending a lot of time in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
A really radical step for humankind is when we lost that opposable big toe. After Artie, some creature decided it didn't have to retreat to the trees anymore. That meant they couldn't go nest in them or escape predators. So that's a radical step. They're living on the ground with all those carnivores, which were pretty nasty. So that's a huge step in human evolution when that happened. So they'd love to see, you know, when did that happen exactly?
We're talking with Ann Gibbons, who is a Science Magazine contributing correspondent and has been following the paleontological issues for a long, long time with Science Magazine. She's the author of the book, The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors. We're talking about the discovery of Ardipithecus and the research being done and what it told us and how it changes some notions of evolution and challenges some ideas. Lines open at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or you can log on to Facebook and throw your thoughts out there, and we'll bring that conversation into the airwaves as well. Anthony McCarthy is with me in the studio. Anthony?
And I remember when all the mainstream media around the discovery of Lucy Now, I think when we get excited, and Mark and I are kind of nerds sometimes because we just really, because when you think about the development of humankind and as much as people go through conversations and debates about faith, this is fascinating to know where we come from. And it really does give us an idea, given the environmental concerns that we have, the environmental realities that we have, where we're going in the future. But explain for our listeners and for Mark and I the difference between that time span of a million years or so along the human development between Artie and Lucy.
This is a really important question. I'm so glad you asked it. I once heard a scientist describe, you know, we've been on life has been on this planet for a long, long time, and if you were to sort of plot the age of the Earth at 5 billion years, humans have actually been, you put that on a football field, humans showed up in the last six inches of the far end zone, right?
Yeah.
I live in the Steeler Nation. I live in Pittsburgh. Sorry to the Ravens fans. But
that's okay. You're allowed.
So I think in terms of football. But that last 6 inches is when the first members of the human family showed up between 5 and 7 million years ago. Now, think about 5 to 7 million years. Artie lived 4.4 million years, pretty close to those earliest members of the human family. Now, that was in Africa. There are several other species of human ancestors. Nothing shows up outside of Africa until about 1.8 million years ago, 1.7. So our earliest ancestors were in Africa for about 4 million, 5 million years. Then a wave of them got out around 2 million years ago, these very archaic members of the human family, Homo erectus. Then around in the last 100,000 to 200,000 years, modern humans arose in Africa about 200,000 years ago, the first members of our species, Homo sapiens, again found by this team in Africa, in Ethiopia, the earliest members. They got out in the last 100,000 years. So you see the time scale, 100,000 years is modern humans getting out of Africa. And one thing I do love is that we all trace our origins to Africa.
Yeah.
And just in the last 100,000 years, as a species, every one of us on this planet, with all these different humans who all look different from, you know, an Aleut Eskimo in the north to a Maasai warrior in Africa, we are actually a lot alike genetically, every one of us.
Right.
There's very little genetic diversity for a species. If you look at two chimpanzees, as few of them are that are left of different species, of different subspecies, they have far more genetic diversity. So we really come from a common origin that's fairly recent, and that's very exciting. But that our species is just a blink of an eye. It's the last 200,000 years. This thing, Artie, you wouldn't invite her to dinner. She doesn't look like us. She's 4.5 million years old. This is an ape, you know. She's no chimp, but she's no human either.
So if Artie shows up at the door.
Yeah, let her in, but, you know, be careful.
You never know what may transpire.
Exactly.
But I mean, one of the interesting things, though, that you've been discovering of late, it seems, or people have been arguing of late,
yeah,
is whether or not that there were many forms of humankind, different genuses that you know, Neanderthal and Homo sapien. We might have been there with some others as well.
I love this. This is something to me that's so amazing. We have Neanderthals lasted in Europe until about 28,000-30,000 years ago. And then there's been this cool new species found in the last 5 years in Indonesia on the island of Flores, the Hobbit, Homo floresiensis, which lived until about 12,000, 13,000 years ago, a little remnant relic species off on this island where it probably escaped the notice of other humans. So this notion that there's one kind of human, this is only recent. And for most of our past, there was more than one kind of human or hominid around. You know, it's mind-blowing to think what it would be like now to have a different species of human around. It's probably good we don't, but, but you know, imagine.
Right, exactly. I mean, what's frightening is some scientists who might want to kind of try to recreate this in the next 25 to 30 years. There's that discussion.
With the sequencing of the genome of a Neanderthal earlier this year, that discussion was brought out. Now, luckily, the technology is nowhere near able to do that. It's a real pipe dream, but it's a terrifying thought. I mean, ethically, there would be such huge issues. Even though we all think we know some Neanderthals, it would be really scary to create one and put it out there, I think.
They might be saying the same thing about us if they were around, but...
You got it. That's true. They were pretty smart. They were pretty capable, Neanderthals, actually.
Now, Anne, give us some context. How busy are researchers? How many sites are being researched around the world? I mean, is this something that is fairly active? I mean, obviously, when someone discovers Ardi, that's pretty significant. But are there projects around the world doing this, looking for our earliest brothers and sisters?
There are. I would say there's surprisingly few looking for the earliest members of the human family in mm-hmm. Africa. The Ethiopia and Kenya, the Rift Center is really the epicenter of human origins. We call it the cradle of humankind. I kind of like to say it's more the graveyard of humankind because that's where the fossils were well preserved. They were all over Africa, but that's where the fossils are preserved so beautifully because of the tectonics that expose the old sediments, the water that buried them quickly, all the right conditions to make a fossil. So there are teams in Ethiopia that are looking. You've heard of Don Johansson, the discoverer of Lucy. His team is to the north of this team. This is probably the largest team out there with the most PhDs on it. There are some Ethiopians now. That is very exciting that are leaders of their own projects. It's so great to see that have earned PhDs and now are heading teams. Johannes Haile Selassie, who's part of this team, is now the curator of anthropology at the Cleveland Museum, and he runs his own expeditions. Selassie Sima is another one who's based in Indiana now, who has a PhD and is running his own. Zeresanai Alemzaget, another man who's now based in San Francisco, is heading his own team too. Kenya, fewer PhDs, unfortunately running their own teams, but a few emerging. South Africa is another big center where people are doing research and finding not the earliest members of the human family, but fossils that are 2-3 million years, so a little bit later in human evolution. Then in Europe, in the Republic of Georgia, and in China, they're finding stone tools in Indonesia of early members of our genus Homo, Homo erectus, that came around 2 million years ago. That's when the brain began to expand.
Mm-hmm.
All these really early creatures have brains and bodies the size of chimpanzees, but they're walking upright. They're not using tools yet. We begin to see tools in the big brain quite a bit later. This is not a really well-funded field. It doesn't get a lot of money for this research. It's really important, fantastic work, but it's extremely hard to do, and it's very hard to get funding and to get permits to go into the field. So I almost think of this field as being almost the ultimate survivor story. You know, these researchers that go do this work have to be incredibly tenacious. They have to be totally passionate about what they're doing because it's not a well-supported endeavor, and they risk their lives. I mean, these are really dangerous conditions that they work in. We saw when I was there in the field visiting, some of the local nomads they're all armed with AK-47s. There's a lot of clan warfare. These are tough conditions to work in.
Well, this has really been a pleasure to have you on the air with us, and this is a very special subject for us here on this show. Every time there's something new happening, we want to talk about it and kind of wrestle with it. And I think that it makes a strong argument for why we need science in schools and to kind of excite young people into kind of looking at this area and discovering who we are on every level that there is. And Ann Gibbons, thank you for all the writing you do.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And I hope that you'll join us again.
I'd be glad to.
Thank you so much.
Take care,
Ann.
Ann Gibbons has been with us. She is Science Magazine's contributing correspondent. Her book, The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors. And we are talking about the finding of Ardipithecus ramidus, which changes the whole evolutionary discussion. And we're going to change another subject in a minute and then talk about a different kind of evolutionary discussion, this one political. Which is that the conservative and right-wing media is at it again, attacking another member of President Obama's administration. This time the witch hunt is for Kevin Jennings, who is gay and a deputy secretary of education. And we'll talk about that and more and what's going on with that and why it's going on. We'll be joined by Carl Frisch from Media Matters to talk about that. I'm going to write something up for Facebook right now so you can join in that conversation when Anthony McCarthy and I return, reminding you Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhof available at 410-783-8000 or bsmusic.org. We will be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are covering the story here that is beginning to hit the papers a great deal about the attack by right-wing media on Kevin Jennings, who works at the Department of Education. And in the Department of Education, he runs the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Carl Frisch, who is with a senior fellow at Media Matters, who covers the goings-on in the press on the right. I'm joined in the studio by Anthony McCarthy. And Anthony, you knew Carl Jennings.
I knew Kevin Jennings.
Kevin,
yes,
Jennings,
yeah. I've met Kevin several times when he was the head of an education organization called GLSEN, which is the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. It was the foremost, and still is probably, civil rights organization working to create tolerance within our school system for not just young people who may be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, but really as an educational resource and tool for school systems, for teachers, as well as parents and students. And so Kevin had come to Baltimore several times. And as you know, Mark, I've been involved in gay and lesbian civil rights for many years. And I met Kevin at several conferences, brilliant, articulate, advocate, unquestionably an advocate on behalf of young people in school systems, teaching and creating a tolerant environment for all people in the public school system. I was very impressed with him and very excited when I heard that he had been appointed a deputy secretary in the education department.
So here are the facts, folks. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to Facebook, and we will start a conversation there in just a minute that you can join. We are joined by Carl Frisch, who is here at the moment. I'm glad to see his name pop up. Senior fellow at Media Matters. Carl, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what's going on in this latest controversy, and give our listeners who have not followed this what has happened.
Well, the story goes a little bit something like this. Fox News and a variety of right-wing outlets like the Washington Times and conservative talk radio have claimed that 21 years ago, when Jennings was a 24-year-old teacher in Massachusetts, that he covered up statutory rape by not reporting to authorities a conversation he had with a student who told him about being involved with an older man. The attacks on Jennings really are just the latest in a series of witch hunts by conservatives in the media against Obama administration officials. And these attacks in particular have had an extremely anti-gay taste to them. WorldNet Daily described Jennings as a radical homosexual druggie. The Washington Times said Jennings had made extremely radical statements promoting homosexuality in schools. I'm still not quite sure how you promote homosexuality. I don't know if you give out toasters at a bake sale or something. Rush Limbaugh and Fox News' Sean Hannity both said that he was promoting homosexuality in schools. And this followed talking points almost to a T from the Family Research Council, which is a virulently anti-gay organization. And they've been after Jennings for months, even before anything about this story had revealed itself. Now, the funny thing is that they made it, all the while they tried to make it sound like Jennings was trying to cover up this conversation that never happened, which was probably true unless you realize that the way they found out about it is they read about it in his memoir. down the spider hole everything went. And in reality, Jennings, if you read carefully what he wrote in his book, he talked about this former student now, 21 years ago, had been 16 at the time. At one point, he had been recorded giving a speech talking about either this or a different student and how sophomores are generally 15. But if you look at his writing and you look at a letter that his attorney wrote in 2004, the student was 16. But of course, that was ignored by the conservative media. You even had people like MSNBC's Pat Buchanan asking if Jennings had a sense of solidarity with the man in question rather than the kid. I kid you not. Media Matters did what Fox News and these other outlets should have done and did some original reporting. And we were in touch with the student in question, the former student who's now in his late 30s.
Uh-huh.
He supplied us with a copy of his driver's license. and a statement. The driver's license proved definitively that if you go by the timeline of events that everybody's using, that he was at least 16 at the time, closer to 17, which was the legal age of consent in Massachusetts at the time. Furthermore, the statement that he gave us, he said that he actually had no sexual contact with this older man. And he praised Kevin Jennings, his former counselor at the school, for being an ear that he could rely on. But that hasn't stopped the right from continuing to go after. As a matter of fact, Jennings, or the former student, also provided Media Matters with a Facebook email conversation that he had with the FoxNews.com reporter who's been covering this, where the Fox News reporter actually describes the him being 15 angle of the story mm-hmm. as a rumor, which was hysterical because that same reporter who was emailing with the student had reported as fact that he was 15. So he called his own reporting rumors. and essentially he was trying to get this former student to confirm various aspects of the story that he had already reported on, whether or not he, you know, he hadn't even checked into it before reporting.
Carl, this is Anthony McCarthy. I want to ask you about, I think one thing that you shared, everything you shared is significant, but the thing that I want to focus on for a second is the Family Research Council actually had been going after Kevin Jennings
for about even 4 months now.
Yeah, I mean, even before his confirmation, correct?
Right, correct.
And so they were focused on this angle.
Well, and the reason you need to know why they've been going after him, and yes, it's because he's gay, but more so, Jennings used to be in charge of an organization called GLSEN, the Gay, Straight, Lesbian Education Network, which seeks to promote school safety. And one of the biggest things that GLSEN pushes is anti-bullying rules in schools, because anybody who's studied the matter knows that gay and lesbian students face a great deal of verbal and physical harassment in schools. So GLSEN made this a big priority. And groups like the Family Research Council are vehemently opposed to any protections for gay students. It's either A, they want them to get bullied, or B, they believe that by bullying you'll make a man of them and they'll grow up straight. Both are delusional. But that is the reason that groups like the Family Research Council have been pushing this.
I mean, have we seen, though, in by the way, we're talking with Carl Frisch, who is senior fellow at Media Matters. We're talking about what Media Matters has been covering, which is the right-wing media attack on Kevin Jennings, director of the Department of Education's Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools.
And just for the record, for people like Fox News, whenever you have a title in the Obama administration with more than two or three words, you automatically become a czar.
That's right.
which, as we all know, is like commie. You're like a commie pinko. If they still had a communist Russia, and yeah, it just kind of falls flat after a while.
And they're all over, though. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, they've all gone after him. Media Matters, as a matter of fact, the Fox Today came out. What did they say Fox Today said, Anthony, about that?
Fox made a correction in their coverage on this Kevin Jennings issue.
On their stories,
On their stories. Now, the interesting thing is the network itself made a correction, but I'm wondering if the Sean Hannity and the other talk show hosts and reporters who've been covering this, will they, in fact,
I wouldn't take it to Vegas. But the funny thing is the written corrections that you saw on the website are actually on the stories written by the guy that was in contact with Jennings over Facebook, which are just hysterical. They even describe the statement that we received from the former student as a conversation between Media Matters and such, which is just hysterical. They can't seem to get anything precisely. So this is what we've been seeing. And, you know, it's not the beginning of this. You know, they've been on a witch hunt for Obama administration officials since the beginning. You know, they seem to have moved on from appointees that are Hispanic to officials who are black. And now they're after our pink brothers and sisters.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Or you can log on to the Facebook page, Mark Steiner, and join the conversation there. And we'll read some of the comments in that ongoing conversation when we turn back to our Facebook page. Carl Frisch is with us, with Anthony McCarthy and I here. He's by phone. We're in the studio. He is senior fellow at Media Matters. And the question we're exploring is the right-wing media attack once again on Obama official. The question is that I would like to explore is, I mean, this clearly are attacking as we talk, Kevin Jennings because he's gay, and they're trying to accuse right. him of they said statutory rape, which obviously we just talked about how that wasn't true, and or of being
two things. It wasn't true because the student says he didn't have sex, and if they had had sex, he was of age.
He was of age, because he was in Massachusetts at 16.
So basically what the conservative media then wants to say, well, then it still wasn't appropriate. What they want, and keep in mind what I said about the Family Research Council against its and the bullying policy, what they wanted then is for Jennings to out this kid to his family, the students, the school, you know, by talking about it, violating the student's privacy, and what would be the result? He'd likely be bullied. Remember, this is 1988.
But he was also being accused of lauding someone who had created NABLA.
Right, which is a complete lie out of whole cloth.
That he didn't do that at all?
No, he founded the Madison Society, which was the first gay civil rights organization in this country, and I believe it was like 65, 70 years ago. And he praised his creation of that group because that group was the precursor to all gay and lesbian civil rights groups.
So my question to you and my question to all of our listeners here at 410-319-8888 is that there's been this constant stream of attacks that have worked by forcing everything from the public plan to be taken off the table. In the teabagging, which I just love the fact the right wing uses the word teabagging. I mean, maybe, right. maybe they're all in the closet and just afraid to come out. But,
well, I knew they were blind. But,
so, you know, I mean, I love that. John Waters talked about it in our show a little while back. He might have, I think he invented teabagging, John
yeah.
Waters. But at any rate, that took place, but the attacks on other administration officials have forced people to resign. From this administration, that the attacks on Sotomayor when she was being nominated, and all the rest. So it's having its effect. The question is, do Democrats and does the White House stand up to defend Kevin Jennings, or do they
well,
hunt him?
It looks like they have thus far. That's been very clear. The Secretary of Education came out in his support. A variety of nonpartisan educational groups and associations came out in support. And on Friday, the day that we had all of our exclusives debunking these myths, CNN did a few reports, and Fox News was absolutely silent on the issue. So for the time being, it looks like Jennings is safe.
But the bigger question, or I think that I'd be very curious to hear from our listeners on, is the power that the right-wing media in these conservative organizations, from the birthers to the teabaggers, they seem to have, by making an enormous amount of noise, they get reactions.
Why?
Yes, that's
Sorry.
Right. They get reactions, whereas progressives don't seem to be as quick, Mark, or as loud in their
right.
Support well, and protection of people like Van Jones, people right. like Kevin Jennings, and others.
It's all in how we think about politics. You know,
mm-hmm.
you'll hear from progressives, oh, we're not going to stoop to their level. We don't have to. You know, oh, don't go negative. You don't have to. They'll come with us because we're rational and we've thought this through, and I can tell you in 18 points why it's important. And all the while, what does the media clamor for? Drama, drama, drama.
Yeah.
So what it's covered. Drama, drama, drama.
But I do want to kind of explore the politics of this, though, and what's fueling this and why it seems to have so much power. I mean, they may not get away with this one on Kevin Jennings, but that battle is not over yet. Let me turn to the phones that our listeners join us at 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I with our guest this hour is Carl Frisch, who is Senior Fellow at Media Matters. Write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page, Mark Steiner, and join the conversation there. 410-319-8888. Dean in Silver Spring, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Dean.
Wondering, you know, a lot of these shows, they make these inflammatory statements merely to boost their ratings, and their ratings help generate revenue for the companies from the advertising they sell. And then these spokesmen from these groups, they come on and they get exposure for their group, and they make money on fundraising. Has there not been a concerted effort to maybe target the advertisers of these shows as a way of bringing reality to their inflammatory comments?
There have been. Glenn Beck in particular, since he said that President Obama was racist, that he had a deep-seated hatred against white people, and then, of course, he said I'm not saying he doesn't like white people, because as we all know, deep-seated hatred and hate are two different things. And then he called the president a racist. Since he made that comment, he's lost almost 70 advertisers on his show. So when you tune in, really, what you, it's like you're watching commercials during a 3 a.m. repeat of Golden Girls. It's like G. Gordon Liddy selling gold, pet medicine through the mail, and a variety of weird gadgets that people invented. So it's having some effect on their bottom line for Glenn Beck. And I wouldn't be surprised if other efforts are launched as well.
But, Carl, the thing that I guess makes me most concerned as we observe this, and Mark and I were determined we were going to put this before our listeners, is that when you start connecting high-level officials who are openly gay, who have been involved in gay and lesbian advocacy, it is controversial enough that they were working with education and students. But when you start talking about sex and young people, I'm not sure how much further Sean Hannity and others have to push this conversation before Obama and the White House get very, very antsy.
Well, they've gone about as far as they can go, and, mm-hmm. and people are sticking with Jennings. So, mostly, I think, because there's no there.
Yeah,
there.
Very good point. Mm-hmm.
You don't even see the real... and I hesitate to say this, Fox reporters on television reporting this story. It's all being driven by the quote-unquote opinion people. I don't really differentiate them, but every now and then you can see that divide at the network.
I mean, but we are seeing something, I think, you're seeing the power of what conservative media in America can generate.
Yes, they've got a megaphone that begins in the morning at Fox and Friends and ends at night after the last re-airing of O'Reilly. That is all day, all from the same talking points, all day long. In addition, they've got the Washington Times. They've got the morning show at MSNBC. They've got Lou Dobbs at CNN. And, of course, my conservative friends will say, well, then you've got everything else. Yeah, that's when you think that it's about conservatism versus the facts. If I wanted to concede that MSNBC had 3 hours of liberal time in the evening, keep in mind you'll see Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz and Keith Olbermann attack the administration when they don't think that they're doing things right. Even if you concede that there are 3 hours of liberal programming on MSNBC, mind you, conservatives will tell you every hour on MSNBC and CNN is liberal, which is just a joke. There are still 3 hours of conservative programming in the morning. There is no such balance out there for what's happening. And I'm not saying that there needs to be a cable network devoted to pushing a progressive line. What I'm saying is that the remaining cable networks, and I don't even consider Fox News a news network, but the remaining legitimate cable networks, MSNBC and CNN, need to be pushing back hard to show people what the truth is.
The problem is that I think that mainstream media doesn't see that in its role.
Well, they do on occasion. You occasionally get it during Dayside on MSNBC where they'll point out how this web works, going from Drudge to FoxNation.com to Rush Limbaugh to Fox News. Or you'll get on CNN, you'll get Rick Sanchez in the late afternoon debunking right-wing myths. You know, the death panel thing was debunked 40 times by the mainstream press. Now, granted, that is competing with hour upon hour upon hour of coverage from the likes of Fox News and conservative talk radio. So it does happen. It just isn't sufficient. But you try and explain to a legitimate news program or producer or host to spend all of their time debunking what Fox is doing, and you're doing two things. One, you're keeping the legitimate news from focusing on stories that actually should be covered. And two, you're reinforcing the myth to a degree. Studies have been done scientifically that show when somebody is presented with a debunking of a myth, a piece of that myth remains inside of their head.
What did Carl, the president's press secretary, didn't he respond to a question about Kevin Jennings?
He may have, I'm not sure.
Okay, I remember, I think he said they're sick, and he was talking about the right-wing commentators. I think he said they're sick.
Yeah, they are sick. I mean, I'm surprised that Glenn
maybe he said
broadcasting from a white-padded room.
They're sad, I think he said.
410-319-8888, your thoughts on the power of conservative.
And I apologize to Glenn Beck for likening him to somebody who needs a white padded room. I apologize to the people that need white padded rooms.
Carl Frisch, who you just heard, is senior fellow at Media Matters. Your thoughts here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to Facebook and join the conversation there at the Mark Steiner Show page, or the Mark Steiner page. Anthony McCarthy's in the studio with us, as he is many, many times, especially every Monday. 410-319-8888. Come to these calls that are coming in just a moment. And the question I want to explore now is this. Just, I really do want to explore more about this power of the conservative media, because, I mean, it's they and the power of insurance companies in Washington, D.C., and the lobbyists, and the lobbying industry in Washington, D.C., which seems to be just as strong under Obama as it was under George Bush, unfortunately, have, like, turned the debate around when it comes to health care. The public option is now dying a slow and painful death because of that, and because partially because of teabaggers, partially because of the things that happened this summer. And it kind of fuels the, in some ways, the soft underbelly of part of American opinion, and really, I think, affects it deeply around issues of race and other things in this country. Anthony?
Especially when we talk about, and Carl may agree with this, I'm not sure, when we talk about that movable middle, that segment of our society, Mark, that doesn't fall one way or the other on the fence. When you see people like Hannity go after, and Michelle Malkin and others go after Van Jones, and they play little clips of speeches that he gave, where they say he signed a petition.
Right.
And that noise generates enough concern that someone feels the need to leave public service. It really does beg the question of, you know, people say, the right wing doesn't have that kind of influence. It's a small minority group. Well, it's hard to see that or counter that when they make so much noise and when they do have successes like pushing Van Jones out.
They're also, you know, when they ask polling questions, I'm glad you brought up the people in the middle that can be persuaded.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ask the right questions. You know, when you look at the middle of the country and look at, I think there were numbers that said 50% were unhappy with Obama and healthcare.
Right.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Of the people in the middle. They didn't delve a little bit deeper to find out if they were unhappy because Obama wasn't fulfilling his promises or if they were unhappy with what Obama was proposing. So, yes, I'm sure some of those people in the middle were shocked to find out that Obama wanted healthcare for everybody, even though he campaigned on it for 2 years. But I'm sure a lot of those people were upset that Obama was not fulfilling his pledge to bring health care to everybody, or seemingly not doing so. So they also don't ask the right questions in polls. Public option remains very popular, and I think we actually have a long ways to go before we see what we end up getting. I don't think it's probably going to happen before the holidays, but I think we're actually in a better position in terms of the public option than we were in the middle of August.
Let's turn to the phones here at 410-319-8888. You just heard Carl Frisch, senior fellow at Media Matters, joined in studio by Anthony McCarthy. And Farah in Laurel, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting discussion because I'm led to observe that having grown up in journalism, I'm really just so curious as to what time, at what point the Fourth Estate actually ceased to become news and actually become under the, you know, news under the guise of political advertising and the mouthpiece of political parties. Perhaps if we look at that aspect and we could then apply the rules of equal time as we do for political campaigning. And if they really want to spend so much time talking about sex in one party, going back to Marx, conservative versus liberal, then they really are going to have to start discussing all the sexual peccadilloes that they have been hiding in their own party.
Yeah, the issue of equal time doesn't apply to cable. It hasn't applied to broadcast or radio in quite a long time either. It's interesting. We all tend to have very limited memories in terms of how far back the media has been having problems or when they became political. The movement to have a media that didn't pull one way or the other really came about after World War II. That's when journalism schools started teaching objective journalism. Prior to that, much of the media was controlled by, you know, very few wealthy people who had political opinions one way or the other. So what's the problem today? I think part of it is that for 40 years, conservatives have been attacking the media for an alleged liberal bias, which doesn't exist, and progressives have just sat on their hands. Which is why I always tell progressives, whatever issue you care about, make sure the media is the second most important issue to you, because it's going to dictate how your issue is covered and perceived by the American people. I think that slowly over the last 5 years, you know, particularly since Media Matters came on the scene, more and more progressives are taking an active stake in their media. I think you are not likely to see any push by the administration or Democrats in Congress for a fairness doctrine or any kind of equal time legislation. And that's why it's so much more important that people actively engage the media. I can tell you without fail that a couple dozen well-thought-out emails to a reporter who has gotten a story wrong or a producer of a show that has covered a story wrong, except for Fox News, will go a long ways towards making future coverage better.
Let me try to sneak one more caller in here before the end of the hour at 410-319-8888. Reverend Meredith, you're on the air.
Hello, all. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I must say, as a journalist myself, among my many trades, I've really been dismayed about how this health care bill has been covered. It's been a form for...
Did you say they actually covered the bill?
Well, I mean, I don't think they covered the bill. It was like pseudo-coverage.
Yeah.
But this, it's been a jump-off for all the right-wing racist nuts. And yeah. I've been very dismayed because there hasn't been a very strong progressive response. I'd like to see more from the president, and I'd like to see more from progressive media. This stuff is really crazy, and it's bred violence. I mean, you know, we want to talk about end-of-life care. People are bringing guns to hear the president. It's madness. And I think that, you know, progressive media has a responsibility to respond and respond swiftly and accurately.
I think the media in general has a responsibility to respond. And here's an example. Like I said, the mainstream press debunked the death panel smear like 40 times. What they didn't do is take the extra step to provide context. It's one thing to say
right. That
they're wrong.
That's right.
The extra step of context would have been, if you want to know about death panels, call your insurance company. Because one of the reasons we're having and they don't even have to make it sound like you have to vote one way or another, but simply put, many insurance companies in this country already practice what could be described as a death panel, which is denying coverage, rescinding care, et cetera, et cetera. So simply by pointing out that fact, which is one of the reasons that the administration is seeking health insurance reform, would have provided the added substance to the debate that was going on without taking a side one way or the other.
Carl Frisch, it is always a pleasure to have you on the air with us, and I hope we can have you back very soon again.
Sounds good to me.
Thanks, Carl.
Take care.
Thank you.
Carl Frisch is Senior Fellow at Media Matters. And when we return from this very brief break, and at the top of the hour, we're going to talk about The Wire and why Britain is so enamored of The Wire. They're having conferences. They're covering it like crazy. A professor from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, is going over there to do her survey, which we'll talk about here. Also, Clark Peters will be in the house, who played Lester Freeman on The Wire. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll be right back to talk about all that. Before we do, let me remind you to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore, Thursday, October the 8th, from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket will benefit WEAA, so don't miss the boat. Call 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628. Or just go online to WEA.org. See you there.